I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Villanova Wildcats outplayed the University of Miami Hurricanes last night in Louisville, beating them 92-69. The Wildcats put the first points on the board and never looked back under the able leadership of their captain, Ryan Archidiacono. They now go on to the Elite Eight and play number one Kansas on Saturday. Today we talk about March Madness, college hoops, what's ahead for the Wildcats, other teams and players to watch, and later in the hour we'll take a look at the role that the NCAA plays in the lives of players and the rights of student athletes. Joining us by Skype is Jonathan Charks. He covers the NBA, the NCAA, and the draft for The Ringer. That's the news, sports, and entertainment site founded by Bill Simmons. And John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, how you guys doing?
And we're doing well. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Jonathan Tannenwald, and he covers college basketball for Philly.com. And Jonathan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here. You got Archidiacono better than a lot of us in the local media do, so congratulations.
I had to work really hard on that. Well, let's start with Villanova. Of course, people are very excited here in the Delaware Valley because of what they did last night. And to you, Jonathan, what were they able to do on the court last night that gave them such a decisive win?
Fantastic game. And obviously, the easy part is that they shot the lights out. I mean, when you do that,
92 points. You're saying
with the kind of scoring talent that they have in Archidiacono, Chris Jenkins, Josh Hart, and so on, you're probably going to win a game in the NCAA tournament when you put 92 points on the board. That part's easy. But the way that they took care of the ball, turned it over very little. Miami threw at a couple points in the game this really ferocious full court pressure defense at him, and you could see how well-trained Villanova was to get the ball up the floor fast for what ended up being wide-open baskets because Miami had pushed everybody up the court. That's the sign of a team that knows what it's doing, that's well-coached by Jay Wright, and really was ready for that game and to make a statement.
John, what did you see last night?
Yeah, I thought coaching was really big in that one. You saw in Miami when nobody tried to put him in a zone. Miami tried to dribble the ball to the zone. They held the ball too much. They didn't move the ball like Nova did. Nova was a better coach, better shooting team. And I'm not sure they had as good athletes as Miami, but it didn't matter because they had the better shooters and they were more better coached.
And they certainly took control in the second half of the game. I mean, once the second half started, I mean, they really dominated. John?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Miami, I thought they were a very talented team, and they just got totally outplayed last night.
You agree with that? Just outplayed offense and defense?
Yeah, I think part of it is Villanova's experience in the NCAA tournament, and they have this really upperclassman-laden team and a lot of guys who are from the Philly area or close to it and have a lot of affinity for playing for Villanova specifically. And, these last couple of years, they've gone out in the first round, they've gone out in the second round, and every year Jay Wright and his players have been asked, when are you finally going to break through, make to the Sweet 16? They got here, they're playing free, they're playing loose, John, they're playing like they're really having a lot of fun, aren't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. John, go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, also it really helps this year. There's not a lot of great teams in their path. Like, Nova doesn't have too many Big Ten NBA prospects, but you look at, like, Kansas, they don't really have those guys either. So it looks like this year is more wide open than it was in the past and they'll make a run.
And, John, when you look at Arch, as he's called, what do you see?
I mean, just a great college guard, He shoots the ball incredibly well last night. He hustles. He's a smart player. That's the main thing. He's a very smart player. Like, you look like Miami's guards last night. They weren't always making the right decision. They weren't moving the ball at the right time. They were dribbling too much. They weren't taking the right passes. But Archidiacono, he made all the right plays when he needed to. That's a senior point guard making the right plays in March.
Well, to you, Jonathan, one of the descriptions of Villanova, the team, and perhaps the coach, Jay Wright, is that they are unselfish players. I guess by that, they share the ball.
Oh, yeah.
Is that true?
It is absolutely true. They share a ball a lot. They don't have the kind of huge individual stars that some of the other college teams do. And Jay Wright has said over the years, he'd rather recruit a four-year guy than one of these one-and-done guys who's going to come, be there for a year. I don't know whether he's going to go to class or not. Then he's going to go to the NBA. And more power to them. But Jay Wright's job at Villanova is to get them as far in the NCAA tournament as he can get them. He's done that with a senior-laden squad. I think this is a team that he really likes, feels really comfortable with. It's the kind of guys that he wants to have. And for all of us who know Jay, who's a great guy, he's very charismatic, he really cares about not only Villanova but the greater Philadelphia basketball community, even some of the folks who grew up rooting for the other schools in town, find it hard to root against Jay Wright specifically.
Well, he's not a screamer, from what I could see last night.
I'm new to this whole thing. They don't show it on TV when
okay.
he's screaming all that much. But all of these guys, even somebody like Fran Dunphy at Temple, who's regarded to be one of the classiest people in all of Philadelphia sports and all of college basketball, I've sat next to him at games where the arena's a little quieter.
You can
hear him a little better. No, I'm not going to say anything on the air, but he's got a blue streak in him, and I'm sure Jay does too when he needs it.
John, let me go back to you. Something that Jonathan just said about the sort of one-and-done players that come in for their freshman year and then, move on to the NBA. Not so true when it comes to Villanova. Do you think that explains some of what they're able to do on the court in that they've played together for at least some time?
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I mean, I'm only for the sense that they aren't playing for their stats because they're not looking at being drafted in the NBA. They're looking at playing for a team concept. And, like, so it's not so much I got to get, like, a certain amount of shots in the game. I have to get my touches. I have to get my minutes. It's like we can all buy something bigger than ourselves because we're not playing just for ourselves. We're playing for a team concept.
And, John, what do you think about what's going to happen on Saturday, Villanova playing Kansas?
Well, that should be an interesting game because in a lot of ways Kansas is like Villanova. I think they start three or four seniors. None of them are really big time NBA prospects. They share the ball really well. They shoot the ball really well. This should be a really, really fun game, like an old school college basketball game.
What do you anticipate, Jonathan?
I have Kansas as the favorite, and it might disappoint some of the Nova fans out there, I realize. But I think even some of the Nova fans know they're up against a really, really big test on Saturday. Perry Ellis, the Kansas forward, Wayne Selden, the guard, are great players. And Kansas, one of the truly elite college basketball programs in the country, has had certainly its share over the years of NBA talent. But this is a team, and I think Kansas coach Bill Self, John, I'd be interested to get your take on this since you're out in Big 12 country. This is a Kansas team that I suspect Bill Self is very happy to have, that he's got all these upperclassmen. Because sometimes when you get these one-and-done guys, as you said, they sort of know already when they're out the door. I suspect that Bill Self, the great Kansas coach, it should be said, he's pretty happy with this team.
John?
Yeah, definitely. Like, he's definitely stuck with these guys over more highly touted players. Like, last year they had two guys, Kelly Oubre and Cliff Alexander, and they were both considered lottery picks coming out of high school. And they went to Kansas for 1 year, and they rode the bench behind these seniors. And this year he has a guy, Shake Diallo, is the same thing, where he had these highly touted freshman prospects, but he has this senior class he loves so much, he plays them over them. They play very much a team concept basketball.
Did you want to add something, Jonathan?
Well, it's the polar opposite of that is a guy who a lot of NBA fans have been watching, Ben Simmons at Louisiana State, who's regarded as the best NBA prospect in all of college basketball, didn't even make the NCAA tournament. First of all, I'm not sure the rest of his team was all that great. But there are some perceptions of him that he didn't really put in the full effort to really put his team on his shoulders and carry them all the way to a big season and into March. And that people notice that. Even if he goes on to have a great NBA career, while you're in college, people notice that stuff.
We are talking college basketball, March Madness. That's Jonathan Tenenwald. He covers college basketball for Philly.com. Jonathan Charks joins us by Skype. He covers the NBA, the NCAA, and the draft for The Ringer. And if you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking basketball. Well, let's shift gears. Jonathan, let me go to you. Can anyone beat the University of Connecticut on the women's side? What are they, 34-0?
Amazing. A historic performance by that program, coached by Norristown native Gina Auriemma. The best player in the country by a lot in Breanna Stewart. And I think the easy answer is to say no. They're going for their fourth straight national championship. Breanna Stewart is going for her fourth straight National Player of the Year award, I believe, which nobody's ever done in college basketball history. There's not as much depth in the women's game as there is in the men's game.
What do you mean by that?
As many really great programs, as many programs that can, not even at the top, that give UConn a run for their money, but sort of the second tier or the third tier of programs. There's a big drop-off after the top, right now, four, and then five or six at most. It really, there's a big difference. You know, UConn's not going to be tested probably until they reach the Final Four, and Whereas in the NCAA men's tournament, there are a lot of upsets. In the women's tournament, there are not so many. It's almost a certainty, not quite, but very close, that all four number one seeds will make it to the Final Four. So Connecticut, I believe, will play Baylor in the Final Four, and then either South Carolina or Notre Dame in the national championship game. And if it's South Carolina, I think that'll be the toughest matchup that UConn gets. They're coached by Philadelphia native Dawn Staley, who a lot of folks, I'm sure even a lot of your listeners
absolutely.
Are well aware of.
Was a guest on Radio Times.
They have a great talent in Aja Wilson, sophomore forward. And they're really good. I don't know that they're as good as Connecticut. And what the only thing I think that can stop them, the Huskies now, is this burden of history that's on them if it gets to be too much. And I don't think it will be. I think they are the favorites to win it all.
What do you think, John?
I don't really cover the women's game that much, so I'll have to kind of see to Jonathan on this one. But UConn, from what I've seen, is just pretty amazing. But beyond that, I really couldn't say too much about what's going to happen.
John, what are some other teams that you're watching, let's say on the men's side, that you're watching, or even some players that we should be aware of?
Well, I think like the game of the tournament could be the one tonight, Indiana versus North Carolina. I think those are probably the two most purely talented teams left in the field. They both play a very fun, up-tempo style of basketball. I expected a lot of high pace, a lot of threes. There's a lot of one-on-one play. That should be a very, very good game. I would say if you're going to watch one tournament game over the next weekend, it's Indiana versus UNC for sure.
How about for you, Jonathan?
Well, I think that's the one to watch for a lot of reasons. I worry that Carolina could win that game going away because they're so talented offensively. But among the many reasons, and it is, by the way, it's not at Wells Fargo Center tonight. It's probably going to start at around 10 o'clock.
This is in Philly.
Yeah, in Philly. Right. It's the second game of a doubleheader. Notre Dame and Wisconsin play the first one at about 7:30, and then Indiana and Carolina at around 10. And among the many reasons why people are talking about this game is that it is a rematch of a national championship game that was played in Philadelphia 35 years ago on the day that Ronald Reagan got shot. It's a great story that a lot of us around here, myself included, have done a lot of sort of retrospectives, how we covered the game at that time, where the people are from then to now. It does have the potential to be very entertaining. I agree with you, John. But North Carolina, at their best, when they're really firing on all cylinders offensively, with Marcus Page, their great guard in the backcourt, Bryce Johnson and Kennedy Meeks in the front court, I think Carolina's got the most pure talent of any team left in the field. And I think that right now I have them as the favorites to win the national championship.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We've got another conversation we want to start as well. That's Jonathan Tenenwald, and he covers college basketball for Philly.com. Jonathan Chark's joining us as well. And again, he covers the NBA, the NCAA, and the draft for The Ringer. We are talking about college basketball, March Madness. Who's up, who's down, and last night's win by the Villanova Wildcats. And we've got Ellen Starowski, who's going to be joining us as well. We'll be talking more about the NCAA. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I've been talking with Jonathan Tenenwald and John Charks about March Madness, college hoops, what's ahead for the Villanova Wildcats, other teams and players to watch. We now want to take a look at the role that the NCAA plays in the lives of players and the rights of student athletes. The NCAA makes hundreds of millions of dollars from TV deals broadcasting the games. Our guest says that players are an unrecognized labor force and deserve a piece of the action. And she is Ellen Starowski, professor in the Department of Sports Management at Drexel University, an expert in college athletes' rights, gender equity, Title IX, co-authored a book called College Athletes for Hire, The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA Amateur Myth. And Ellen Starowski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. You say that college athletes, they're not like other students. They're not like other workers. What are they?
They're a class unto themselves as a result of the rules that the NCAA has used to regulate their lives. And I think that as a result of that, we have an undervalued labor force that has not been given the status that they need in order to access their rights.
Are you talking about paying them the way coaches get paid or others that are making money off of, in this case, basketball?
You know, the framework that oftentimes is used is this idea of, you know, that when we advocate for athletes to be viewed as employees or recognized as a labor force, that we're really arguing for pay for play. And number one, I do find it a little strange that people balk at the idea that someone would get a paycheck for working. But I think it really misses the central point, which is that we have a system in place that athletes are not a member too. For example, there is no athlete in the United States that is a member of the NCAA. There is no existing framework that allows them to have a seat at the negotiating table or the bargaining table. So the result of that is that all of these rules are unilaterally imposed on them in a way that is that meets the interests of the industry, but do not meet their interest. And so so they work in unsafe workplaces. They don't have proper medical care, both short-term and long-term. They are undervalued in terms of their labor. They don't have access to the one thing that they are promised, which is a meaningful education. So rather than thinking about this just as a paycheck issue, it's really an issue about gaining access to the rights that they should have and the mechanism in order to be able to affect change on their own behalf.
Would that include things like unionizing, for instance?
Certainly, there have been some attempts to unionize, and it's interesting how even the National Labor Relations Board, you know, avoided the question. Instead of, you know, they didn't say that college athletes weren't workers, but they wouldn't really. You know, really take the next step of saying what they are. So I think that that unionization may be one way. I think if you think of it in terms of professional sport, where we have something called the NFL, and then we have the NFL Players Association, which is an independent organization that creates a counterweight. That's really what's missing in this discussion in terms of the NCAA. There is no counterweight on the other side. And so it allows college and university programs as members of the NCAA and conferences to effectively, you know, run their business pretty much unregulated. So I think if people think about it that way, that there's not a counterbalance on the other side that's an independent voice for athletes, then we need some kind of advocacy mechanism like that.
Well, Ellen, let me get our other guests back in on the conversation, Jonathan Tennenwald and John Sharks. Jonathan, what do you say in response to what Ellen is talking about here?
No need to respond. I'm right there with her.
I mean, you were nodding.
Yeah, I agree.
Enthusiastically.
I agree 100%. And part of it to me, it's not just that the scholarship itself doesn't cover the amount of money that you need to have an actual life on a college campus anymore. That's one thing, because you can vary by smaller amounts, the amount of money that are in the scholarship, as some of the conferences like the Big Ten are starting to do. The problem is that the amount of revenue that is being generated in college sports now by the television networks, by ticket sales, by merchandise that have the players' numbers on them, but the players don't get any of the money out of it, is so far out of proportion.
Hundreds of millions,
yes.
Right?
For the players to get none of that in any way really isn't fair. And I think deep down there are some people who work at these various colleges who know it. But so much of this money goes to the athletic directors and the administrators and then into the gigantic 100,000-seat football stadiums with luxury boxes just like there are in the NFL. That's where this sense of unfairness comes from.
Let me get John. Let me give you a chance to weigh in on this as well. What do you think?
Sorry, I've been having some connection issues. I just got back on the call. Missed what you guys just said. Sorry about that.
Okay. We'll come back to you. Let me go back to you, Ellen. I was reading some of the things that you have written, that one of them, that the idea of the student athlete is a fiction or a myth. How so? Mm-hmm. How so?
Yeah, it actually is a invention that was created in the 1950s. It's a legal term of art that was used to deflect attention from the way that from the fact that the NCAA was being hit and schools were being hit with cases around worker compensation issues. And so Walter Byers, who was the executive director of the NCAA at the time, who was a media person, he understood how media worked. He worked alongside of his legal team to come up with this term. And then he sent out a memo to all sports information people and instructed them that they were to use the word student-athlete instead of players. And effectively, it's been one of the most effective propaganda campaigns that's ever been executed. There's an intentionality there that the term was to avoid worker compensation claims. And it's been very effective in covering over what the real issues are.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Ellen Starowski. She's a professor in the Department of Sports Management at Drexel University, joining us in this portion of Radio Times to talk about what she has observed and her criticisms of the treatment of student athletes, as to use the word there that she doesn't like. And we're also joined by Jonathan Tannenwald, covers college basketball for Philly.com, and Jonathan Sharks, who covers the NBA, the NCAA, and the draft for The Ringer. You can join the conversation. Any questions or comments you might have, particularly about this portion of what we're talking about, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, you had a chance to listen to a little bit what Ellen has said, and you do cover the NCAA. What do you say now?
Well, I think for me, like a lot of it covering the NBA draft, you see it from the other end of the things. And it really starts with the NBA and the NFL not wanting to have real minor league systems. And so they kind of push these guys into the college sports system, and they probably shouldn't be there to begin with in the first place. And I think that's really, I think, where I would start looking at it is, why are these professional sports operations that are worth billions of dollars, why aren't they investing money in developing their own talent? Why are they making the colleges do their work for them? That's kind of destroying the system in a lot of different ways.
That's interesting. Let me give Ellen a chance to respond to that, and I know you want to do that as well, Jonathan. Go ahead. Ellen, go ahead.
I really appreciate that observation that we have professional sport entities that are using the college ranks to develop talent. And what's most interesting to me, if you think about that basketball arena with thousands of people who are going to be in it, and then the millions who are watching on television, and the athletes at the center of it, not only is it just the professional ranks that are allowing the college system to develop their talent, but the Olympic movement also does. It also feeds off of this system. We have sport apparel companies that are making money off of this system. The gambling industry is projected to have $9 billion in action during March Madness this year, a little plus
$9 billion.
We have 24/7 television coverage and media outlets that feed off of this. So when you think about the number of entities that actually have built their businesses, not to mention tourism, for instance, that this is the magnitude of what's happening here. It isn't just that the NCAA is getting $725 million from the television contract. It's all of these other entities that are monetizing this event, making a profit off of it. And so you have the players at the center with this enormous economic inequity that are really subject to what would otherwise be called collusion. Collusion between the professional leagues and the NCAA. And these are clear labor issues.
Jonathan, go ahead.
You were talking about the gambling, and I'm glad you did, because you want the great days to go to Las Vegas during the year, go on Super Bowl Sunday, go on the first 2 days of the NCAA tournament when there's 16 games a day, and there are buzzer beaters or shots right at the end that are affecting the point spreads, and all the gamblers out there are losing lots of money, and not one cent of that goes to any of the players who are involved. It's absolutely true. you know, when you're at these games at the Wells Fargo Center here in Philadelphia or wherever you may be, in the moments before the tip-off, they show these NCAA publicity pieces about all the various quote-unquote student-athletes who are not basketball players, who are swimmers and soccer players and fencers and volleyball players and whatever they may be, a lot of whom actually do go to class and do put the work in and are not the ones who are generating the revenue, even though their programs, to be fair, are benefiting from the revenue that the big teams generate. Right. And they do put in an honest effort, but they're being used to protect the NCAA's image. And to go back to something that was said earlier, it's not a myth, this whole student-athlete thing. As Ellen said, it's been enshrined in law, and that's part of the fight here to get that overturned. And unfortunately, you have a lot of people who are politicians in this world at local, state, federal levels, you name it, who are big fans of their alma mater's football team, and they don't want to do anything that might hurt their chances of winning a national championship.
Ellen, as Jonathan was talking, I was thinking about the case at UNC of academic fraud. There was a report that came out about athletes who didn't have to go to classes and basically were protected from having to get an education. How widespread do you think that is?
I think it happens all over the place. I know that some folks think that that's a conspiracy theory, but I think that if you look at the number of occurrences of these things happening, it's very interesting within the NCAA. For example, when they bring athletes into the system, they check their transcripts from high school to college. So they do something called the NCAA Eligibility Center. So they require that these transcripts get reviewed before they come in. But interestingly, on the other side, there is no such effort to do so. And I think that that reveals everything. The NCAA has the mechanism in place to do the same kind of things in terms of current athletes on college campuses. They refuse to do that, but they require it in terms of entry. And so there's a question to be raised there, which is, well, if you're so invested in making sure that they have legitimate classes coming in, then why do you suddenly lose curiosity once they are in? And I think that that pretty much says it all.
Well, I know you want to say something, Jonathan. Let me get Patty from Horsham to join our conversation, and then we'll give you a chance to respond. Go ahead, Patty. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, okay. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I just have a comment in that there were end question in terms of why are athletes held to this different standard? I mean, the whole system for tuition-based education, money floods in from the federal treasury, and there's no guarantee for kids to, A, graduate, or, B, get a job afterwards. And the student-athletes, if that's the name we're going to use,
right,
they get upwards of $200,000-$400,000 educations. And I look at my kids, for whom I paid every penny plus interest, I'm still paying, and they also had to do unpaid internships in order to make their, you know, themselves known to their industry and whatnot. So I don't know why the athletes have this, oh, poor athletes. All the students are getting a raw deal, and I'd like some comments.
Sure, Patty. No, I appreciate you calling in. Jonathan, since I said you'd give a chance, a response, but I'd like to hear from Ellen as well.
I think it ties into what Ellen was talking about a minute ago, that the athletes are more prominent and more valued in that way on campus.
Plus, they're making lots of money
for the
university or college.
The great physics student or the great student of literature doesn't help the job security of the athletic director or the basketball coach any. But the NCAA is, as they will tell you many times over, a membership organization. They do what their members want. And what do their members want? Their members want to win. And the members, really, are the athletic directors who pay the coaches' salaries and who are trying to win national championships because then they can bring in more money from donors to build better stadiums and arenas and practice facilities and whatever else they may be. And one of the people who's at the center of this is Roy Williams, the head coach of the North Carolina basketball team that's here in town to play tonight. And there are a lot of people, Ellen, who think that he knew more than he's letting – or, well – I was going to say he knew more than he's letting on. The more accurate thing is to say who wonder how he didn't know.
What was happening with his players.
Right. And you know, you hear all the time stories of coaches who go have a word with the teacher who's maybe thinking about giving the player a grade that would make him ineligible. And if the coach knows that you can't do that, that is illegal under NCAA rules, so they have an academic advisor go and do it on their behalf. It's all really sketchy, and it's not as bad everywhere as it is at North Carolina. And there are, Ellen, some places where it is perfectly legitimate and noble to do that, just not for the reasons that Carolina's been doing it, I think.
Ellen, mm-hmm. You want to respond?
Yeah. I really appreciate the caller's question.
Sure.
And I think it is something that it defies our logic in terms of why athletes seem to be in this position compared to undergraduates. And there are two points I'd like to make. Number one, a diploma does not mean that you have a meaningful education. Within this system, where you do potentially have fake classes, where you have people writing your papers for you, where there's a manipulation, and, for example, there's a lot of tracking into favored majors with favored professors and those kinds of things, that there is a distinction between a diploma versus a meaningful education. The second piece of it is...
You know what,
that,
Ellen? Let me just jump in here. Can you stay with us a little bit longer?
For a couple more minutes,
okay.
Honey, and then I am going to have to run.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, don't leave us. Don't leave us. Only because we have to take a very short break. It's built into the program here. And then we will get back to our conversation. That's Ellen Starowski, professor in the Department of Sports Management at Drexel University. Jonathan Tannenwald covers college basketball for Philly.com. And Jonathan Sharks covers the NBA, the NCAA, and the draft for The Ringer. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking about several different things, including Villanova's win last night, what's ahead in March Madness, and also talking about the NCAA and its treatment of athletes who play for colleges and universities. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Ellen Starowski, who has to leave us in just a couple of minutes, Jonathan Tannenwald and Jonathan Charks about college basketball. Ellen, you had a second point. Go ahead.
Yeah, the second piece of this is that the athletes that we're talking about, their lives are very, very regimented and very controlled by their work experience. And this is the reason why the fact that they're not recognized as employees is so problematic, because that scholarship creates in the mindset of their coach that these players are workers. And so the idea that an athlete would scale back on their participation in their sport in order to be successful students is just not going to happen, because the pressure to win is so great. And when you're involved in a sport media entity like this, where you have millions of people watching, there's an expectation that you're going to come and play at a very high level. And this is where negotiation becomes so important, because it need not be a situation, in my mind, where we have all of these hypocrisies. I think that there's a way, if athletes were able to sit down to the table to negotiate, where maybe they're not full-time students during the spring semester. The University of Hawaii was not on campus for something like 2.5 to 3 weeks during this conference and March Madness time period. So I think that there are ways that these things can be dealt with that would actually serve both enterprises if there was the opportunity to negotiate, and we would not confront these kinds of questions about the lack of academic integrity. I think that there are ways to achieve those goals, but because the system is so set on putting out this pretense that athletes are like all other students when they're not, I think it creates a whole river of other problems that we encounter every year around this time.
Well, I'm going to let you go. Ellen Starowski, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, she's co-author of the book College Athletes for Hire, The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA Amateur Myth. She's got a forthcoming book, Women in Sport, Continuing a Journey of Liberation and Celebration, and also working on a book to be entitled Big Time Athletes, Labor and the Academy. 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. John, I didn't want to ignore you. Anything you want to add to what you've heard in the last couple of minutes?
Oh, I thought Ellen made a few great points. I mean, the first thing is she's absolutely right that it's a job. Like, these guys are playing for their job every season in the rotation and the starting lineup. And if you don't produce, they're going to bring somebody else and take your job, and you'll lose your scholarship, and you have to transfer somebody else. That's why if you look at, like, in the transfer market these days, I mean, you're talking maybe, Jonathan, how much are the numbers? Probably like 100 kids transfer a year between D1 colleges, probably more than that even. So there's a huge turnover every season on these teams.
You know, I'm thinking, I'll be totally honest here. I don't watch a lot of college basketball. I did watch last night in preparation for the show. And, it's a beautiful game. These young people play at such an incredibly high level. I'm sure they're learning things about winning and losing. And so there's kind of this disconnect between the beauty of watching college athletes play a sport like this at such a high level and what we've been talking about, which is the fact that they have so few rights when it comes to being a student at a university. Jonathan?
And a lot of them do want to play. And a lot of them and their families, especially those who come from underprivileged backgrounds, very much do value the college scholarship and the free education and the things that may come from that if you put the work in once you get there. Unfortunately, to Ellen's point about what it's going to take to get the NCAA to come to the bargaining table, they're not coming to the bargaining table of their own free will. They're not coming to any table of their own free will. They've proven that for many, many years. The only way it's going to happen is if somehow the college players withhold their labor and walk off the field.
Really? A kind of a strike?
Yeah, right. The risk of that is so high. I'm not going to say too high, because I would like to see it happen, but it's such a high risk for these
and
kids.
And it's asking young people to do something that could hurt them.
And to take in all of this information and context and so forth, that when they have all of these things filling up the time in their lives, it is very hard for them to do. There is one counterpoint, though, and one group of schools in Division I that do things a little bit differently. As much as everybody likes to mock the Ivy League for a lot of reasons that it's worth mocking them for, they don't do athletic scholarships. In fact, they don't do merit-based aid of any kind. And people, in fact, even who know that they don't do athletic scholarships, a lot of people don't know that they don't do merit-based aid at all. So you can't get merit-based aid for academics. You can't get it for being a good tuba player or a good dancer or whatever it may be. And the Ivy League does work hard to make sure that the athletes are treated the same as all of the other students in as many contexts as they can be. And yes, they're going to miss class to travel. And yes, they're going to, have a lot of time commitments because of basketball. And you do see, even in the Ivies, if there's a class that you want to take that you know is at the same hour as the basketball practice, you're probably not going to be able to take the class. That's understood. But then again, there are other circumstances on a college campus where that happens. I have my own set of issues with the Ivy League. It's a league that I cover in depth. I know a lot of the people who work there and set these rules. But I do think their model has merit in a lot of ways. And I will say, they have had a lot of success in the NCAA tournament. They've got perfectly good basketball teams, as we saw this year with Yale and past years with Harvard and Cornell. I'm sure you've got a lot of listeners, Marty, out there who went to Penn, who wish that Penn was in the conversation right
Absolutely.
Now. They're not.
Absolutely.
But the Ivy League has shown that you can be successful with the model that they have.
John, you want to add anything to that?
Well, I think for me, I guess, at this kind of issue, I always look at the structural concerns. I'll give an example of that. Like, sure. I went to UT Austin down in Texas. And Austin is a massive city. It should have its own professional sports team, but it doesn't. Because the NBA has a monopoly, the NFL has a monopoly, baseball has a monopoly. So that kind of pushed all that energy into the college sports scene, to UT Austin. So they become professional sports franchises instead of college things. And I think that's like the underlying issue with a lot of this stuff, is that there are only 32 pro sports teams in each league. But there's, 100 American cities that want pro sports teams?
Yeah.
And that becomes, that energy goes into the college system, which it probably can't realistically sustain its absorb while maintaining academic standards at all.
Let me read a couple of comments here. A tweet actually saying a pro sports degree program. Why not? I guess getting a degree in basketball, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, look, there is merit in that argument, because if you are going to college to learn the skills that are going to get you a professional career, playing basketball may well be your professional career. Now, what happens after that is an open question. But I think there's some merit in that argument. And, John, you know, it's funny. I cover soccer in addition to college sports. You had me worried that you were going to go down the promotion and relegation argument like they have in English soccer. But you've got down there in the UT football team as close to a pro sports franchise as exists in college sports, don't you?
John?
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, they have to win games. That's the bottom line. And I think the point Ellen made earlier is, like, it goes back to the high school level, like, in terms of passing kids who can't graduate. Like, this goes back to, like, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. And when they get to college at that point, what are the schools supposed to do? These kids got to get on the field, and they can't go to class. So sacrifices are going to be made.
I read a book about that written by a local author. Let me get Miles from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Miles, go ahead. You're on radio. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to say, first of all, I think that any time there's one group of people working to make money for another group of people, the workers deserve to have a voice. But I wonder if anyone on the panel knows anything about other students who generate revenue for universities. So I was thinking engineers who, you know, might get patents working tremendous hours. And I don't know, are they compensated differently? Do they sign away everything to the university?
I mean, it's a good question. And I think that that's why this is such an important conversation to have, because of all the questions that it raises. Jonathan?
I have seen some examples of that. I don't know too well, but I do know, and maybe Marty down the road, you might have somebody on from Penn or Drexel where they do a lot of these sorts of things where they have their engineers and they try to foster patents and innovations and things like that. I do know that some deals have been struck over the years by some of these universities who give the kids the workspace in exchange, maybe for a percentage of, you know, that's what an incubator is in a lot of ways.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So, but nothing on the scale of what happens in sports.
John, I raised this earlier. I mean, when you watch, and this is your job in many ways, to watch things like college basketball, and knowing that the players are perhaps being, what, ripped off or not getting what they are owed, does it in any way hurt the game for you, or hurt watching the game, or ruin that experience for yourself?
I mean, not really. You know, I guess you do this long enough, you get a little cynical. Like, I don't believe in Santa Claus either, but I feel like right? It's all good.
An email from Doug. I believe the college athletes in revenue sports should receive a reasonable stipend and a guarantee of a full scholarship at the college that they played at when their playing days are done. An email from Peter. What about the argument that academic requirements are racially inequitable? John Thompson at Georgetown advocated that for years.
John Chaney at Temple did
and
too.
And John Chaney too. Right.
The scholarship point is a fascinating one, and I'm glad that came up. For many, many years, your scholarship, when you played for the basketball or football or whatever team, was a one-year thing that was renewed at the coach's discretion each year, which was part of the inequity of the system. Now you are starting to see, especially in the major conferences, although I think that is one of the things that will trickle down to the smaller conferences, that they are putting a guaranteed four-year or for as long as you are in college, if you're going to leave early, go pro, scholarship on the table, and that is very helpful. It's long overdue.
Let me get Chris from, looks like Point Breeze, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing? The one thing I haven't heard any of your guests talk about is, you know, their proposed plan of you know, everyone's talking about how there's inequality in the system, but the reality is these student athletes are getting six-figure education for free, and you know, what they make out of their degree is up to themselves. But you know, how can we make it more fair?
It's a good question. John, do you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, for me, if I look at changing the system, I'm scrapping the whole thing. Like what they do in Europe. At Europe, they sign guys at like 10, 11, 12 years old. They have actual professional teams, and they coach them and develop them themselves. I think FC Barcelona is most famous for this. They have their academy where they pretty much just raise these kids in terms of athletes and as people. And it's not a part of the school system at all. And to me, that's the only way to really, quote unquote, fix the system. Because as long as there's this kind of disconnect between a professional sports league, minor league, and a school system, I'm not sure they're ever going to be really fixed 100%.
Let me read a comment from Brian. He says, one thing that hasn't been discussed is that scholarships aren't guaranteed for 4 years. They have to earn them each year. Some schools guarantee them, others don't.
That's what I just said. That's starting to happen now where they are guaranteeing them for 4 years. You mentioned the academy structure with international soccer, which is something that Major League Soccer here in the United States is doing. In fact, the Philadelphia Union, the team here, and FC Dallas, John, the team in your backyard, are two of the best at it, where they have high schools and they have these kids. It is full-time, and then they help them when they get to the right age. They'll have online college degrees or something like that. One of the things I wonder about the inequity of the system, though, if you're going to pay the players as semi-professional athletes in addition to the money that they are getting in scholarships, and the commenter said to get their degree, well, they're not always getting their degree. That's part of the problem.
Right.
If you pay the players, the football players and the men's basketball players, and in some cases the women's basketball players, and in a few cases the baseball players, and in a few cases the soccer players, but not very many, are the ones who generate the revenue. How do you pay everybody? Do you only pay the football and the basketball players? Because if you do that, you got a big Title IX situation on your hand, and I think rightly so.
I'm going to save that for a whole other hour because we're almost out of time here. John, let me go back to you and go back to the games ahead. We talked about Villanova playing Kansas on Saturday. What other games are going to be played, and what should we be looking for, John?
I think, as I said earlier, the Indiana-UNC game tonight should be pretty good. I think hopefully all the games tonight. I think Gonzaga-Syracuse should be interesting. And I think the Elite Eight games from last night's games. So you got Kansas-Villanova, and then you've got Oklahoma-Oregon. Those should both be pretty entertaining.
How about for you, Jonathan?
Gonzaga-Syracuse, as morality plays go, is a fascinating one for me because Gonzaga isn't a football school. It's really a basketball-only school. And Syracuse, for as great as their basketball program is, has a lot of football money in it, and it'll be very interesting to see if Gonzaga can beat Syracuse. In fact, really, of the teams left, Gonzaga and Villanova are the only ones that don't play major college football. And it's a story every year. I mean, Villanova is obviously a basketball powerhouse. So has Gonzaga been in recent years. But it's always a story to see how far those teams go against the Kansases and the Oklahomas, which is obviously a huge football school. North Carolina's got plenty of football money. Tonight in Philadelphia, you got Wisconsin and Notre Dame. As far as big schools do, it doesn't get better than that, you know?
We're almost out of time here. Can Villanova go all the way, Jonathan?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they can get – I just think at some point, whether it's Kansas now – Oklahoma in the Final Four, North Carolina in the title game, it's going to be too much.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Jonathan Tannenwald, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And Jonathan Charks, thank you for joining us as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And we're going to close things out with a little music to get us all in the mood for Villanova.